It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday has arrived, and we have with us Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa, in our Cedar Falls studio. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Ben.
Let's start off with you. Hopefully, Wayne will join us shortly. Sure. Today's program, we want to sort of start in politics here in the Midwest, in Nebraska, here in Iowa, and then... Wayne, I hear you're there. Wayne Moyer.
Yes, I am.
Welcome to our program. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We're going to start off with politics here in the Midwest, in Nebraska and Iowa, and talk about some national politics, but then also get some reaction to politics here at home caused by the abduction in Nigeria. Also, an update on the crisis in Ukraine. If you'd like to join our conversation anytime during the hour, 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Yesterday, a Senate primary, Teabagged Party Republican Ben Sasse comfortably winning his party nomination for the U.S. Senate in Nebraska yesterday. Here's what the Omaha World Herald wrote, that his dominant win in the Senate primary affirms Tea Party influence in Nebraska. The Wall Street Journal: Mr. Sasse's victory gives the conservative groups what may be their only major win during the 2014 primary cycle. Let's start with you, Chris Larimer. The significance of this win for the Republican Party, for the Tea Party faction.
Well, I think it's significant for the Tea Party faction in Nebraska, at least. We saw last month where you had a Tea Party candidate in the North Carolina Senate primary not win that primary. So I think for the Tea Party, this is a significant win because what's interesting is earlier this month, Gallup released a poll showing that support for the Tea Party was down 10 percentage points this year compared to in November of 2010 when their support was really at its highest. It went from 32% down to 22%. So the fact that the Tea Party can still win a primary, I think, is very significant for supporters of that group.
So are we seeing... I quoted the Wall Street Journal saying that maybe the Tea Party's only major win during the 2014 primary cycle. Do you see that as well, Chris?
Well, I think so. I think it's hard to find cases where the Tea Party is doing well just because of what happened in 2012. Many people look back at that election and say there were candidates in Missouri or Indiana that were maybe a little too extreme or just didn't fit well with the general election and the electorate in a general election. So I think in what we see from the Gallup poll as well suggests that the support for the Tea Party is waning, and that certainly seems to be the case in Iowa as well, as we saw from some recent Des Moines Register Iowa polls. But I think, you know, going back to the election in Nebraska, this was significant. This was a big win. This was over 27 percentage points. The Tea Party-backed candidate, you had folks like Mike Lee, Ted Cruz, Sarah Palin coming into the state, folks who are associated with the Tea Party. And that seemed to make a difference. Originally, this was deemed to be a close race, a three-way, Ben Sasse, Shane Osborne, and Sid Dinsdale. And in the end, you know, the Ben Sasse came out on top and quite easily.
Yeah, the one question I would – this is Wayne. The one question I would ask about that is apparently there were some Tea Party people on both sides in Nebraska, and I'm wondering – if the Tea Party, it is so clear that it was absolutely a Tea Party victory.
Oh, okay. That could have been in Tea Party and chosen another candidate in this race?
Well, I think the Osborne also had some Tea Party support locally, if not nationally. And so I'm wondering how unified the Tea Party actually was, or the Tea Party members actually were, in terms of the actual election outcome.
I wonder how much influence you feel Sarah Palin might have in here, Ted Cruz, when they come to a state like Nebraska or come to a state like Iowa and campaign for candidates. Joni Ernst has been given endorsement by Sarah Palin, hasn't she, Chris?
Yeah, it's a great question because if you look at – I think most people see Sarah Palin as someone whose influence has probably been waning over the last couple of years. But if you look at the case of Nebraska, she endorsed Deb Fischer in 2012 in the U.S. Senate primary there. Deb Fischer came out, won that primary. It was a surprise win. Then she went on to win the general election against Bob Kerry, is now a U.S. senator from Nebraska. She endorsed Ben Sasse this time around. Again, someone who kind of came out of nowhere, or someone who was not seen as the front runner initially. And Ben Sasse wins. And now Sarah Palin has endorsed Joni Ernst. I should say that Sarah Palin also endorsed Pete Ricketts in the primary for governor, the Republican primary for governor in Nebraska. Pete Ricketts won a narrow victory there last night. And, of course, Sarah Palin has now endorsed Joni Ernst. So there, at least she does seem to be picking candidates that end up doing well. Whether or not it's her endorsement that is making the difference, she seems to be picking candidates who are able to come through in the end. It's always hard to determine whether or not political endorsements actually matter. They probably do matter more in a primary where party ID is irrelevant, and we're not bombarded with all the information we are in a presidential election where an endorsement might stand out more. But at least in Nebraska, the last couple of election cycles, Sarah Palin has endorsed winners.
When you speak of key endorsements, let's talk about news moving from Nebraska east to our state here in Iowa, the political scene. Key endorsement, Chamber of Commerce endorsed Joni Ernst for U.S. Senate. I suppose snubbing the Republican rival of Joni Ernst, Mark Jacobs, who's been campaigning on his experience as a business executive. Joni Ernst also carries a concealed handgun. She makes that no secret, uses a gun theme in one of her campaign advertisements. She has received the National Rifle Association's endorsement this week for the U.S. Senate race. Let's listen to the ad from put out by the Joni Ernst campaign that features her arriving at a gun range on a motorcycle.
She's not your typical candidate. Conservative Joni Ernst, mom, farm girl, and a lieutenant colonel who carries more than just lipstick in her purse. Joni Ernst will take aim at wasteful spending, and once she sets her sights on Obamacare, Joni's gonna unload. Oh, and one more thing. Joni doesn't miss much.
Give me a shot. I'm Joni Ernst, and I approve this message.
Less than 3 weeks before the primary, the GOP primary for that Senate race, June 3rd. Chris, how do you size up the significance of these endorsements for Joni Ernst?
Well, again, I think you have to think about it in terms of this being a primary, not a general election. You know, for the most part, and really any political information is always going to be filtered through someone's partisan attachment, whether or not they're a Democrat or a Republican. In this case, you know, you're talking about just Republican voters, so party ID kind of goes out the window. And this is what political scientists in some cases would call a low salience or low information election. So an endorsement like this may increase vote share. It may not change people's minds, but it might increase the vote share for Joni Ernst. Maybe someone's perhaps more likely to come out and vote, or it helps make that decision for a voter who may not have been paying a lot of attention, because all the polls that we've seen to this point for the Senate race or various congressional races around Iowa show that voters are not paying a lot of attention, or at least they don't know a lot about the candidates. So if you have a big-time endorsement by the NRA or the Chamber of Commerce, mm-hmm. I think that actually can make a difference.
Is Joni Ernst one of the in these latest polls shown to be a top candidate?
The polls that I've seen, and there haven't been a lot there, and it's hard to gauge sort of the reliability of them, some of them, but I've seen it. Excuse me. Most of the ones I've seen have shown Joni Ernst and Mark Jacobs as sort of the top two candidates, and then there's a significant drop off before you get to the other three.
Wayne Moyer, did you?
I think the endorsements are interesting. You have Mitt Romney, the Chamber of Commerce, and Sarah Palin all supporting Ernst, and I'm wondering to what extent this indicates that Sarah Palin is being co-opted, if you would, into the mainstream Republican Party away from the Tea Party.
Interesting. In terms of endorsements, we have mentioned in this this primary race, Sam Clovis got the nod this week from conservative activist Bob Vanderplaats of the Family Leader, and also Rick Santorum. So when we think of Joni Ernst, is she the establishment candidate, Chris?
Well, I think that's hard to determine at this point. You know, as far as her positions, she hasn't been in the state Senate for a real long period of time to establish herself, whether or not she's an establishment conservative or a Tea Party conservative. But as Wayne said, she has backings from a number of different groups that sort of go across the Republican spectrum. I think what's interesting about the endorsements is that, you know, you think about these usually as newspapers, interest groups, or political elites. She has the political elites in Mitt Romney and Sarah Palin. She has the interest groups now with the Chamber of Commerce and the NRA, and so she's starting to build up a pretty significant list of endorsements that people are readily familiar with.
And when you have endorsements, doesn't that help in fundraising, of course?
Of course, absolutely. That's one of the key things that you put out there for your fundraising when you're doing a mail drop. You're saying that I'm backed by so-and-so, or I'm backed by this group or that group. Absolutely.
Now, should let's just speculate a little bit. Should Joni Ernst win this nomination? How do each of you size up the matchup between Joni Ernst and Bruce Braley on the Democratic side, Wayne Moyer?
Well, I think an awful lot of it will depend on the campaign. I think it could go either way. Ernst will have to explain how she stands on a number of different issues. She got into a little bit of trouble earlier this week, saying that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq in 2003 when the U.S. went into the war, when clearly the evidence was that there weren't weapons of mass destruction. Those kinds of things could get her into trouble. Braley has had the experience of being in Washington for several years, and so I think in some ways maybe more prepared on the issues.
Mm-hmm. But also not immune to having a comment get him in trouble.
Absolutely.
As we heard in the last few weeks. What is your view, Chris, on an Ernst Braley matchup, especially this, as we've talked about for years, if elected, Ernst would be the first woman elected to represent Iowa and Washington.
Yeah, I think this has been a fascinating Senate matchup to watch, because a lot of national pundits or analysts have initially looked at Iowa as one of these battleground states, a state that the Republicans had to take over or to win to take over the United States Senate. And initially, the probabilities put out were, 55, 60% chance of Republicans winning the seat. Those have come down a little bit, down to maybe 25, 30% chance. And I would tend to agree with those. I think, and we've talked before on this program, sort of about the geopolitics of the state. You have, just in terms of a vote share, counties like Blackhawk, Dubuque, Scott, Lynn, Johnson, and Polk, those are very urban counties, very Democratic counties. You have a lot of votes there, and that makes it very, very difficult for a Republican candidate to win statewide office. And I say that, obviously, with two big caveats, and that being those being Terry Branstad and Chuck Grassley have obviously figured out how to win statewide in Iowa. But for a relatively unknown candidate going up against someone like Bruce Braley, who has represented those urban counties, or is at least familiar to voters in those counties, I think the vote share part of it makes it difficult for whether it's Joni Ernst or Mark Jacobs.
Our political analysts this week, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. We invite your calls and your questions, 1-866-780-9100. As we look toward the November election, the immigration issue will certainly figure somehow into the election. We don't know how prominently it might do that. Yesterday, President Barack Obama gave a deadline for immigration reform, saying there is an opportunity in the next few months to pass immigration reform before the November midterm elections take over Washington and, with it, the attention of Congress. President Obama has been pushing to revise U.S. immigration laws and create a pathway to citizenship for some 11 million undocumented residents. But a bill that passed the democratically controlled Senate has been stalled in the Republican-controlled House. Here's the president's words yesterday, some of them.
This is something that has strong bipartisan support. Keep in mind that my predecessor, George W. Bush, was a strong supporter of this. We have a fascinating cross-section of people, some unlikely bedfellows, some very liberal folks, some very conservative folks, who all believe that now's the time to get this done.
And in a comment that caught the attention of Republicans, especially the U.S. Chamber of Commerce President and CEO Tom Donahue delivered a message for Republicans on immigration reform. Here he is speaking at a panel Monday on America's infrastructure.
If the Republicans don't do it, they shouldn't bother to run a candidate in 2016. Think about who the voters are.
Okay, and an attention-getting comment there. Update us, Wayne, on where the GOP is in this issue. We heard Obama say that this is there's bipartisan support here, but the problem here is within the GOP not being unified on immigration reform, or enough of the GOP being behind this.
Yeah, I think the key thing here is this is a congressional election year. It's not a presidential election year. And I think a very significant number of Republicans do not see that they will gain in their own congressional districts by supporting immigration reform now. And I think that's the hang up. even though I think the Republican leadership wants it, I think there's a significant number of Republican congressmen who do not think that supporting immigration reform will help them in this election, while if it was a presidential election, it would be a very different story.
Mm-hmm. And certainly in its primary season, any GOP candidate that is pro-immigration reform, Chris, is attacked, right?
Absolutely. I think Wayne hit the nail on the head. You're talking, I mean, for members of Congress right now, they're thinking about the next two elections, and that's probably the primary, if they haven't had one already, in this November. And for voters in both those elections, immigration reform, for the most part, for Republican voters in both of those elections, immigration reform is not going to be a top priority. The concern among the leadership, as Wayne alluded to, is the fact that going back to the presidential election, Republicans lost by significant margins among, you know, Hispanic voters, close to 40, 45, 46 percentage points when you look at the Hispanic vote for Romney compared to Barack Obama. And so there is a difference there when you're talking about a midterm election versus a presidential election and the likelihood of something like this going through.
Mm-hmm. When we go past the midterm election to 2016, how do we not get the same result with the Republican Party lacking sufficient backing for immigration reform and ending up in the same place that they were in 2012, Wayne?
Well, I think the question there is how much do they really want to win the 2016 presidential election? My suspicion is that that election is extremely important for them, and I think that will add pressures that we don't see this year.
Barack Obama said there is a window of opportunity here before we get into election fever. Do you think, Chris, that the House leadership could go over the heads of the grassroots and cut a deal with a sufficient number of Republicans in the House to make this happen?
I would be very surprised if immigration reform passed. We have seen nothing from this Congress or the last couple of Congresses where bipartisanship is possible for both houses of Congress. We've seen it with the immigration bill that passed the U.S. Senate last June. There was some bipartisan support with, you know, Marco Rubio, Lindsey Graham, John McCain, and others. But beyond that, we have not seen it happen with both houses of Congress, and I would be very surprised if immigration reform went through before the November elections.
Chris Larimer and Wayne Moyer are political analysts this week. Let's talk about when it's okay to question a candidate's health, and that goes back a number of years. It pops up periodically. Reach out to our listeners. When is it okay to question a candidate's health? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org, our email. Carl Rove making several comments at a Los Angeles conference last week where he questioned Hillary Clinton's health after a fall in December of 2012. He said in this interview, 30 days in the hospital, and when she reappears, she's wearing glasses that are only for people who have traumatic brain injury. We need to know what's up with that, quoted in this interview. However, this week during a Fox News interview, Rove backed off of these comments, insisting that he was simply questioning a serious health episode and not saying that Hillary Clinton has brain damage.
No. Wait a minute. No. I didn't say she had brain damage. She had a serious health episode. My point was that Hillary Clinton wants to run for president, but she would not be human if this didn't enter in as a consideration. And my other point is this will be an issue in the 2016 race, whether she likes it or not. Every presidential candidate is asked for all of their health records by the New York Times. They turn them over to vice presidential candidates. They turn them over to a battery of doctors, and they examine them in detail. And my point was that everybody says she's going to run, and she probably is. But I would bet it's a more complicated calculation than we might think because, look, she'll be 69. By the time of the 2016 election. She will be 77 if she serves two terms, and this ends up being an issue.
Okay, Karl Rove, lots of reaction to the comment that he made, even criticism from his own party. Wayne, what do you see behind Rove's remark, the initial one?
Well, he's obviously trying to call attention to the health issue, and I think it's a legitimate issue. But I think the question is here, he went way over the top. He didn't have his facts right. There was a lot of innuendo involved here. And I think that is counterproductive in terms of the Republicans. I think it is more likely to hurt than to help.
Do you agree with that, Chris?
I do. And frankly, it's not all that surprising that Rove would say something like this. I think he's simply just trying to, you know, flame any doubts among Republicans or those who do not like Hillary Clinton or do not like the prospect of a Hillary Clinton campaign, and just putting that out there and then being able to deny it. I think this is just something that kind of is expected given the dislike between Karl Rove and the Clintons and the idea of a possible Hillary Clinton campaign for president in 2016.
Let's squeeze in a caller before our break. Jeff is in Iowa City. What's on your mind, Jeff?
Yeah, I think this whole issue of Hillary Clinton's health is, I mean, Rove's a dirty fighter. Everybody knows that. But I think what's going on in Iowa now is a kind of stepping back by Iowa Democrats from the prospect of having a coronation, which is what everybody assumes would happen. You know, a U.S. Senator, Bernie Sanders, is coming to Iowa tomorrow to speak at the Clinton County Democratic Hall of Fame dinner. And obviously he's interested, or he wouldn't be coming to Iowa, which is a long way from Vermont. And, you know, when a U.S. senator comes to Iowa, and it was asked to come by Democrats, and this won't be the first Democratic event that he'll be invited to, I think this may change the dynamics of the campaign.
In what way do you think, Jeff?
Well, I think we'll have a candidate and a campaign other than Hillary Clinton. And there's a lot of enthusiasm for Senator Sanders. I mean, he's not a Democrat, but he caucuses with the Democrats.
Okay.
He's worked closely with Harkin. And I think people would like to see a progressive voice as the nominee instead of just a rehash of the old Clinton campaign.
Jeff,
and I also think there's been some press coverage of this in the Gazette. And, I think it's something worth following.
Jeff in Iowa City, thanks. Let's get a quick reaction. Chris, do you see that? Hillary Clinton having a serious rival here. Joe Biden has been mentioned, but now we have Bernie Sanders there mentioned coming to Iowa.
Yeah, I'm not sure if Hillary Clinton does have a serious rival just yet. That doesn't mean it can't happen, as Jeff said. But, the comment by Rove, I think, is directed at Republicans. It's directed at maybe some Democrats who do not want to have Hillary as the nominee. But for folks who are excited about Hillary, these types of comments do nothing. They're not going to dissuade them or push them away from a Hillary Clinton campaign.
Chris Larimer is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Hope you'll continue listening and perhaps join in to our political discussion on this Politics Wednesday. When we come back, we'll go international and find out about international events that are affecting politics here at home. The abduction in Nigeria, how that's affecting politics here. Also, an update on what's the crisis in Ukraine. That's when we return. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Wednesday. Wayne Moyer is with us of Grinnell College. Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, and talking about many different facets from here in the Midwest of politics, national politics, but also going abroad in the next few minutes to talk about Nigeria and Ukraine. We want to know, in terms of what the U.S. can and should do, we want to reach out to you and ask, in terms of action, how involved should the U.S. be in locating the abducted schoolgirls in Nigeria? 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. The U.S. and other Western powers, we've heard in our news, have stepped up military assistance to the Nigerian government as part of a mounting international effort to find and rescue more than 200 teenage girls abducted by Islamist militants. That was almost a month ago. U.S. surveillance planes have begun flying missions over remote areas of the country. Washington has sent experts to help with the search and provide the government with satellite images. The plight of the schoolgirls and the desperation of their families has captured world attention with the abhorrence focused on Boko Haram. This is the violent jihadist group that is holding the girls. Protests held in cities around the world yesterday. Wayne Moyer, why has this mass abduction gained so much political significance around the world and here in the U.S.?
Well, I think the biggest part of that is that it went viral on YouTube. And, of course, taking 250 girls captive and with a government in Nigeria unable to do anything about it, and with the grieving and all the families taking place, I think it's hit an emotional chord around the world.
Mm-hmm. Michelle Obama delivered this week's weekly presidential address. This was, I believe, her first time doing it solo, and she took time to talk about the White House's commitment to finding the Nigerian schoolgirls.
Like millions of people across the globe, my husband and I are outraged and heartbroken over the kidnapping of more than 200 Nigerian girls from their school dormitory in the middle of the night. This unconscionable act was committed by a terrorist group determined to keep these girls from getting an education. Grown men attempting to snuff out the aspirations of young girls. And I want you to know that Barack has directed our government to do everything possible to support the Nigerian government's efforts to find these girls and bring them home.
Michelle Obama in the presidential address, the weekly address, her solo address there for the first time. Here's a collection of audio from the political magazine online containing reactions to Michelle Obama's address there. And the fact that during her talk, at one point, she held up a sign with the hashtag, Bring Back Our Girls.
I do not know how adults stand there facing a camera and say, bring back our girls. Are these barbarians in the wilds of Nigeria supposed to check their Twitter accounts?
It cannot force a crazy person to do something, but it can shame a less crazy person into not doing nothing.
Some on the right are playing ugly politics and mocking First Lady Michelle Obama's Bring Back Our Girls photo.
You can't base your policy on what's trending on Twitter. It has to be more than hashtags and selfies.
Is that not pathetic? What the hell message does that say? It is just unbelievable.
Okay, comments collected by Politico. George Will, you heard there. Fox News contributor John Stewart, Mike Rogers, the House Intelligence Committee Chairman, Rush Limbaugh there. Your view, Wayne Moyer, on the first lady weighing in on this.
Well, I think that adds to the credibility of a U.S. government response and probably the international response. I think it does express a U.S. commitment to get some action taken here.
Mm-hmm. Chris?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, what this does is it's a way to build support, build public opinion and mobilize supporters on this particular issue. I mean, as Wayne said, it's a very emotional issue. As the First Lady mentioned in her speech, these were girls who were just simply going to school.
Take us back, Wayne Moyer, and give us some background on what's happening in Nigeria. Remind us how we got to this point.
Well, first of all, Nigeria is a very rich country because it has an enormous amount of oil. But the money is concentrated in the south, which is largely Christian. And the northern part of the country, which is largely Muslim, has not gotten the benefits, if you would, of oil. And particularly this northeast corner of Nigeria where the kidnapping had taken place. And sort of out of this discontent, Boko Haram grew. Very violent, but the government response to them is also very violent, and a lot of very innocent people have been killed in the process. This is just the latest move, if you would, in this civil war, which I must say the government has handled very ineptly.
Our government or the Nigerian government?
The Nigerian government. Absolutely.
How would you assess the U.S. government response here?
I think the U.S. is doing what needed to be done. We're not sending troops in. We're sending experts in. We're sending aircraft in. We're using our satellites. We're giving them intelligence. I'm pretty confident that if the girls are kept together, that we will probably find them. But I think the more difficult thing then will be to get them back without the girls being hurt.
Mm-hmm. Let's shift our view to Ukraine. Talks to end the crisis in Ukraine have begun in Kiev, brokered by some international monitors. Wayne, the Russians are there along with the EU, also the Ukrainian government, but noticeably absent any pro-Russian rebel representatives from the east. Ukraine's military this week suffering its heaviest losses to the rebels so far in the fighting, where rebels control a number of the towns. Donetsk and the neighboring region of Luhansk have declared themselves, from last weekend's referendum, separate from Ukraine. That referendum deemed illegal by Kiev, by the U.S., by the EU. Russia said it respected the votes. Let's talk about, Wayne, first of all, the talks ongoing right now. What can these talks achieve if the pro-Russian rebels are not represented at the table?
Well, they can't achieve anything yet, but essentially the talks are about separation of powers between the national government and regional governments. And the Russians want to transfer most executive powers to the regions and give a lot of autonomy to the eastern region. And presumably then the eastern region would link up with Russia. And the western region would be able to link up with the EU. I think there's an opportunity here, and that the referendums over the weekend, they strengthen the Russian position in negotiations. But I don't think Russia wants to absorb the East. I think what it wants to do is be sure that the eastern part of the Ukraine stays close to Russia. So I'm hoping that what will happen is that the Russians will put pressure on the separatists in the east to eventually join the negotiations. And I'm also hopeful with the EU brokering it, because I see it as a gain for everybody that they can reach some kind of accommodation on the separation of powers or decentralization. The alternative, I think, is a civil war, which I don't think Russia wants. And I don't think the Ukrainians want, and certainly the Europeans don't want it either.
Could this also explain the Russians' behavior, Putin's behavior, different than when we had back in March the annexation of Crimea? For instance, here, the separatist leader of this self-declared Republic of Donetsk didn't waste any time announcing that his province wanted to join Russia. But the question seemed to be whether Moscow was interested. Russia avoided any suggestion it would react, Wayne, with the same speed that we saw after the Crimean Peninsula referendum in March. This time, here's the Kremlin statement after that referendum, say that it respects the will of the population of Donetsk and Luhansk regions, and that the crisis should be resolved through dialogue between representatives of the Easterners and the national government in Kiev. So this is what you're talking about, Wayne, that Putin sees it not in Russia's interest to go the way Crimea did?
Yes, I think they're very different situations. Remember, Crimea was Russian before Khrushchev gave it to Ukraine. The Russians regarded the Crimea as Russia. They do not regard eastern Ukraine as Russia. Taking over the Crimea is enormously expensive for Russia. If it tried to take over eastern Ukraine, the expenses would increase enormously, and then there would be problems of even holding on to control, because there are still many people there who are loyal to a Ukrainian government, and it's not clear economically what Russia would gain by absorbing eastern Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Let's move from Ukraine to something that hasn't been on our news. Wayne, perhaps you can update us on Syria. We've talked many weeks in the past about Syria, and now it's dropped out of our headlines. What's going on there?
Well, the UN special representative for Syria has resigned. And at the same time he resigned, he's talking about uses of chemicals again by the Assad forces. This time it's chlorine gas. Of course, the devastation continues. The human rights abuses continue. The killings continue. The refugees continue to increase. It's an absolute disaster. And some people are beginning to compare it to the Rwanda situation, where the world stood idly by, well, there were, in that case, 800,000 people killed.
Mm-hmm. What's at stake now for the U.S. and Syria?
I think we're in a bind who do we support? And what will bring this war to an end and the casualties? The only way that I could see it happen is if somehow Russia, the United States, Europeans all came together and somehow or other kind of arranged for some kind of international presence to force the Assad regime to cease and desist and reach some kind of accommodation.
Mm-hmm. Today, in our news, mm-hmm. U.S. President Obama meets with the Syrian opposition leader in a show of support for the foes of the Syrian President Assad. The nature of this, what do we know about the rebel forces? They've changed over time, haven't they, Wayne?
Well, it's a very mixed bag. I mean, you have a number of groups that are essentially jihadists, some of them linked with al-Qaeda. There are some who are genuine Democrats. But it's not clear to me that there is any kind of unity among them, and I think that's part of the difficulty. There's some cooperation between them, but they're also conflicting with each other. So it's not clear that there's any one group that that could lead to a more democratic Syrian society that would have any real chance of taking over.
Wayne Moyer is with us of Grinnell College, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, reflecting on some of the political developments within the past week, as we like to do on Wednesdays. If you have something in politics that we haven't yet talked about this week that you'd like Wayne or Chris to comment on, please join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org, our email. Let's talk about a couple of other items here in national politics. Last week, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky started a minor storm by saying that this was an interview in Memphis, that Republicans were making too much of the voter ID question. His quote, "Everybody's gone completely crazy on this voter ID thing," Rand Paul said. "I think it's wrong for Republicans to go too crazy on this issue because it's offending people," unquote. However, this week, Rand Paul backpedaled. He told Sean Hannity yesterday that his comments got overblown in the wrong way. Chris Larimer, voter ID, a question here in Iowa as well. Yeah. What do you make of this episode, Rand Paul, first making this statement, then feeling the need to walk back the comments?
Well, I think the initial statement relates to what Wayne mentioned earlier about immigration reform. Rand Paul, for everything we've seen so far, is focusing on a very different electorate than what's going to be in November of this year. Rand Paul is presumed to be exploring a bid for president in 2016. Voter ID laws, just like immigration reform, you're talking about a different electorate, an electorate that the Republican Party has struggled with the last two, three election cycles, for presidential election cycles. So it's a way to sort of try to pick up Republican votes. It's a way to shift the electoral map in the favor of Republicans by not focusing on things where, such as immigration reform or voter ID laws, where Republicans have traditionally struggled, that is, with low-income voters or minority voters. And so I think the initial statement by Rand Paul was thinking about November of 2016. I think the backpedaling is just trying to not cause any concern among primary voters for Republicans this year or Republican voters for November of 2014.
Wayne Moyer, what do you make of it?
I think Chris has hit the nail on the head. What's not clear to me is what this then means in terms of the message that gets out to the general public. Focusing attention on voter IDs and dissent within the Republican Party, does that strengthen the general opposition to voter restrictions? It's hard for me to really say.
In our Secretary of State, Matt Schultz has been into IDs. Remind us of what's going on here in Iowa, Chris, with the voter ID.
Yeah, this was something that Secretary of State Matt Schultz talked about on his campaign in 2010. It has been a big advocate for voter ID laws in Iowa, or at least our reforming voter ID laws in Iowa has had issues with in the Iowa courts dealing with voter ID and voter fraud. You know, the success of those investigations has not been all that great in the sense of numbers, in terms of the numbers of people actually convicted of voter fraud. But it's been an issue, and it was a big issue for Secretary of State Matt Schultz, who's now, you know, running for the 3rd Congressional District. But we haven't seen a lot of evidence in terms of really large numbers of people committing voter fraud in Iowa. But it was an issue that was brought up by our Secretary of State. It seems to be fading now a little bit. There hasn't been a big push for it yet in Iowa, but other states have certainly done that. And there's been the predictable backlash from Democratic candidates or Democratic elected officials saying that this hurts low-income voters in the state who tend to be Democratic voters.
Another development in national politics, as expected, an energy efficiency bill failed on Monday in the Senate, which makes a separate Senate vote on the Keystone XL oil pipeline unlikely before the November election. Now, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid made a Keystone vote contingent upon the passage of another bill, the energy efficiency bill. Chris, can you tell us the story behind that?
Yeah, so there were two things, as you mentioned. There was the energy efficiency bill that President Obama had pushed for, and then there was the Keystone pipeline that's been talked about for, you know, a couple of years now. And Democrats were not able to end the debate on this. They were not able to separate the two issues. And it was a case where the amendment and the bill itself ultimately failed, where they were not able to get enough bipartisan support to push through both energy efficiency and the Keystone pipeline that, as you mentioned, Senator Harry Reid, the majority leader in the Senate, wanted to keep the Keystone pipeline separate. When you look at this debate, I think it, and, you know, we mentioned immigration reform as well. Some of the numbers that we've seen recently, you start to figure out why the public is so frustrated with what is going on in Congress. We, you know, the approval of Congress is down at 15%, according to Gallup. There were two polls released earlier this week by Gallup showing that 22% think that most members of Congress deserve to be reelected. Only 50% of the public says that their own member of Congress should be reelected. So trust and confidence in those who are already in government is at an all-time low. And it's things like immigration reform, it's things like energy efficiency, which you presume that most members of Congress would be behind, are simply unable to go anywhere in the Senate or go in the Senate but not in the House or vice versa. And I think these types of debates start to explain a lot of the frustration that we see within the American public.
Let me just add very, very briefly.
Go ahead, Wayne Moyer.
It's very sad that the energy efficiency bill failed. That had support on both sides of Congress. And to hold it up for the Keystone pipeline and also the Obama restricting of the EPA in terms of power plant emissions, they should not have been linked to the energy efficiency bill.
Well, why did the energy efficiency bill explain why it failed, Wayne, with bipartisan support?
Well, it failed because the Republicans wanted to add amendments to it, which would have permitted the essentially authorized the pipeline and would have rolled back the Obama administration emissions restrictions or proposed restrictions, which are about to go into force.
We have just a few seconds left. Perhaps each of you can mention a thing or two that you're looking forward to on the political horizon for us to be aware of. Well, Chris Larimer?
I'm looking forward to more ads by Joni Ernst. I assume she's going to release more ads these last few weeks of the campaign. I'm looking forward to seeing more ads both by her and the rest of the Senate candidates as well as the congressional candidates, because this is the time when these ads are most likely to be effective, as the last few weeks of a campaign.
And Wayne Moyer.
Internationally, I'll be very interested in the outcome of the election, which is taking place as we speak in India, and with a right-wing nationalist candidate likely to become prime minister.
Wayne Moyer, Chris Larimer, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Lindsay Moon. And we had help in Cedar Falls today from Tony Daner. If you'd like to hear podcasts of any of our programs, simply go to iowapublicradio.org. Tomorrow, an entire hour on the politics of Africa. We hope you'll join us. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.